I think we're all here.
Hi, everyone. Yes. Hello. Not everyone knows, but this time around it's different because we're like physically in the same city with Val. And we just, we basically had this weird first time ever experience of, catching up. And drinking coffee, discussing the show, what we should ask, how it should go. And despite that it happened the first time ever, it felt supernatural as if we do it like 75 times a month. So I'm so very happy to host you
here. Thank you so much. I keep saying this, that it's not silver lining, but just the cool thing that this whole situation has done is that I've been able to meet so many new, amazing, and awesome Ukrainians. And I've met both of the Ukrainians on this Twitter space in real life since all of this kicked off. So I'm really excited for today. And
yeah. And it's it is a bit special for me as well, because this weekend was really tough for everyone. Once again, we were exposed to the detailed evidence of genocide and what has been done to Ukrainian bodies in Mariupol, and all these horrible images, and then what was happening and is happening in Severodonetsk and Lysychansk today. And of course, it's like we all as Ukrainians were having very extremely challenging weekend emotionally and some physically. And it's nice to see you and embrace a fellow Ukrainian and a friend, especially these days, it matters extra. I know it sounds cheesy, but it's so true.
It's true, it's true. And yeah, I feel the same way. So 100%, it's important to have a support system of Ukrainians around you as well. So
absolutely. And today, that's why our featured Ukrainian today is also feels like a special attempt to make things more therapeutic, because it's one of our most favorite people ever in terms of Ukrainians and in terms of Ukrainian voices. So, Olha, hey, you're with us, right?
Hello.
Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава. Thank you so much for having me here today. And I just want to echo very quickly how, despite all of the horror that's happening, I do feel so grateful that I've been able to connect to so many people in Ukraine. Because, I left when I was so small. I left when I was 12. And then, it's really just close friends and family that I've been really connected to. And obviously the readers of my books and everything. But meeting you guys and other activists and artists and writers, it's just been an amazing thing to be connected like this. So thank you for having me here as well.
Hola, so please introduce yourself to everyone else, to fellow Ukrainians and our allies and friends who are listening, who you are, what you're doing, and most importantly, how your life has been since the start of genocide.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Olya Hercules. I was born as Olga Hrebenyuk in the south of Ukraine, in Khersonshina, in a small town called Kakhovka. I left Ukraine when I was 12, and I lived in Cyprus, and then I went to university in the UK, and then I retrained to be a chef when I was 26, and worked in restaurants and all sorts of things, and then eventually I've written my first cookbook in 2015 called Mamushka, and then I wrote another one called Caucasus about Azerbaijani and Georgian and Armenian food. And then I wrote a regional Ukrainian cookbook called Summer Kitchens, and my fourth cookbook called Home Food is coming out in July. And how I've been, as you mentioned, the weekend has been tough. And in general, I think just similar to everyone else who's going through similar things. You know, it's a huge roller coaster. So some days I feel quite powerful and energetic, and some days I feel, you know, completely kind of destroyed. So it oscillates quite a lot. Although, of course, you know, your brain gets used to anything. So I'm trying my best to keep myself together, you know, with kids and everything. You really have to learn how to do that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, actually, because this was one of the first things that we sort of bonded over and discussed as well, which is that I just remember from the very beginning having this feeling that I felt so sad that I was not able to travel Ukraine and see Ukraine as much as I wish I did. And you had, obviously, with your book Summer Kitchens, you were able to travel and talk to a lot of people across the country and a lot of Ukrainians, and you know, through recipes and cuisine and food and things, that discover Ukraine in more depth than I guess ever before. And I know we usually ask this question at the very end, but what do you think, based on all of this, what do you think being Ukrainian means for yourself, but also more broadly for a person?
So just very quickly, you know, for my cookbook Summer Kitchens, I've decided to kind of record people's stories and recipes all over Ukraine, and to highlight how diverse Ukraine is, you know. So we traveled to all of the borders, we traveled to the center. The only places that we weren't able to travel to were Eastern Ukraine and Crimea, even though I did try, but it was too dangerous to go to Crimea because I wanted to talk to Kirimli, you know, Tatars from Crimea. And basically I, with Summer Kitchens, because there are differences, you know, in climate and landscapes and people, in ethnicities, in, you know, the diversity is staggering of Ukraine, and it's amazing. But everybody had the summer kitchen, yeah? Whether you're somewhere in Western Ukraine, or you're in Alexandrivka and the Tatar family, or you're in Poltava or whatever, everybody in the, you know, in the rural area or a small town would have a summer kitchen, which is used in September to preserve things and to cook throughout the summer, etc. So to me, of course, I'm maybe talking from my own kind of perspective, of a very kind of quite subjective, maybe a personal perspective. But even after having traveled, to me, definitely there is a huge thing about Ukrainians and their connection to the land, to the actual earth, to the soil, to the land, like to our country. It's not just a concept. It's literally, it's something that you can touch. It's the black soil. It's the stuff that we grow up with, and what it gives us, what we grow, the importance of home. Now I'm realizing more than ever, like how attached, like how important it's been throughout the ages. You know, just like the chata, you know, the home. It was with the peach, and how, you know, the traditions of even painting. I don't know, flowers with these twirly ornaments that would catch, you know, the evil spirits. And like there's all of these things that are like so deeply kind of interwoven in, I don't know, with our understanding of ourselves and the world, and it's all about homeland and family, like, to me, and freedom, you know. And obviously, in order to enjoy all of those things, like, freedom is huge, and it's not just us as a nation, you know. In my kind of like a subjective way, you know, looking at my grandmothers and my mom and whatever, like it's the women, in my understanding, in Ukraine have always been extremely free as well. Like, at least in, you know, in everything that I've grown up with, like my grandmothers were proper matriarchs, you know what I mean? So it's this kind of freedom, land, family, you know, all of these like very visceral kind of like things. That's what it means to me, I think.
I was really moved by one of your posts on the Instagram that you shared. It was like a week ago, and there is a picture of your family on one of those summer kitchens. You know, like I remember it very well, because you come from southern Ukraine, I come from southern eastern Ukraine, and we had those summer kitchens where we would come together with, you know, many generations of a family, cooking and then eating during summer. And unfortunately now, when a lot of those places are under occupation, and it pains me that the summer is coming, and this is something that we won't be doing this year much. And you write, you share a picture of what I understand your family in Kakhovka. Was it in Kakhovka? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was my mom's house.
And it's just so moving. But can I also ask you, like, how do you feel about the same kind of a struggle that this year it won't be the same, and this year we won't be doing this quite crucial thing, bonding with our families at our summer kitchens, eating, cooking, which feels like completely devastating, at least for me this year.
Oh, it's a source of constant kind of, you know, deep pain. I mean, you know, I may have left Ukraine when I was 12, but every year I would come back, you know, at least twice a year, even more often if I was able to. And obviously, you know, when I had children as well, it was just, you know, the summers, or at least, you know, the whole of August would be spent with my parents. And, you know, and we have this, that's what I've written about. We have this thing that I've kind of initiated 8 years ago when I turned 30. I was just like, okay, so I'm abroad. I have also family that immigrated to Berlin. And there's also a whole lot of family all over Ukraine, you know, because my mom is the youngest of six children, so the family kind of mushroomed into this huge, you know, family. And I just thought, we really need to get together, all together, at least once a year. And we decided to make it in August, you know, this, we call it the summit. And everyone, you know, I come with my children and my husband, my English husband, then my Berlin family come, then people from Berdyansk come, and from Odessa and Lviv and Kyiv and all over the place, and we get together. So yeah, it's been, I can't believe it. I can't. I'm trying. I'm working towards acceptance, because, you know, otherwise I just, you know, we can't continue. I can't keep supporting my parents as well, who are, you know, feeling it as well, and the rest of my family. My mom and dad, you know, they weren't gonna go until I kind of just had a panic attack with them on a video call. I just completely lost it, and that's when my mom realized that I'm just going to lose my mind if they stay there, and I have to, you know, I was just disabled, like I was paralyzed with fear, because they started getting threatening phone calls from the local collaborator, whatever. So the house is there, and it's devastating. And my mom, you know, she planted tomato seeds. There are little tomatoes, like there are plants growing now. And you know, what I wrote in that thing, yeah, it was just like, the hope for me, I'm just like hoping that the plants will grow big, and then the tomatoes will be huge, and they will burst, and they will self-seed, and hopefully next year, next summer, we can come back, and there's going to be some crazy, wild, you know, sporadically, like, self-seeded, self-planted plants there. But I don't know. That's, yeah. I think if we lose hope, then we might as well just kind of give up completely, so.
Really wanted to go back to our to summer kitchen, to cooking, because I wanted to ask you one of the probably things that a lot of foreigners do not even realize. But when I was growing up, I had, you know, had no idea that so much of our kitchen or our cuisine, that the dishes that we feel and know are integrally Ukrainian, with a lot of time got appropriated and stolen by colonists, specifically Russians. And a lot of famous Ukrainian dishes with hundreds and hundreds of years of Ukrainian history are well known as Russian ones abroad. So I understand that is probably something that you also get asked or maybe face sometimes often, but is there, apart from borscht thing, But is there something else you would like people to know that is you feel like being unfairly appropriated and people should know that it's very 100% Ukrainian?
Oh, well, this is a really tricky situation. Not with Bush, with Bush 100%. And it pisses me off so much when, I don't know, there was like a Guardian column, like how to make a perfect Bush or whatever. And it just says like, it's a Russian soup. And that was just, my heart was just like, no, you know, but I didn't say anything. It was just like, okay, you know what? That was like before the war. I was just like, bloody boring, but okay, fine. You know, but at the same time, you know, it's really difficult to, I can't really think of anything else that anyone else kind of like contest as much as borscht in terms of like, you know, colonization. I don't know. I mean, there are so many dishes that, but nobody, for some reason, nobody says like "ovarenikia" Russian, you know, like I haven't heard it anyway. Maybe somebody does, but I haven't heard anything like that. But food is, I am anthropologically kind of like quite clued in, and I realize that no culture is exists in a vacuum as well, you know, in terms of, for example, you know, holubtsi or something like that, for sure that at some point came from, you know, the Ottoman Empire or something. It's like a cousin of dolma and et cetera, you know. Does it make it less Ukrainian? No, of course not. We've made it our own, blah, blah, blah. But it's, I find that it's quite a tricky subject talking about this kind of thing in terms of like who owns what. Because to me, like, you know, whenever like a British person, for example, that's a different thing, of course, but whenever somebody cooks my recipe in their home, it's their recipe. I always say that, and I'm like, and people get really nervous sometimes. They're like, oh, I didn't have this ingredient, and you know, I hope you don't mind. This is how I made my borscht. And I just say, listen, like, the kind of my philosophy at home and with cooking in general is that you should be using ingredients that are local, that are, you know, very specific to you or whatever. So if somebody else tweaks a recipe and makes it their own, that's absolutely fine. Like, I actually encourage that rather than like, oh, okay, like, I can't find dill in Italy. Oh my God, like, I have to drive somewhere to get this ingredient or whatever, you know? So it's very fluid for me in that sense. But borscht, I mean, yeah, I can, you know.
That's the one, Will.
That's the one that, come on, yeah. And it's been extremely annoying, to be honest with you. Because honestly, like, I would just cringe every time. You know, just look at the things like, oh, and this Russian dish, borscht, and it's just like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And yeah. It was with borscht that after having traveled all over Ukraine, and come on, like, people make borscht in Poland. People, you know, I have friends, the Iranian friends that make borscht, you know, like it's traveled, it's good, it's a really good dish, you know, it's natural. But yeah, still having traveled all around Ukraine, and when you can see the variety within Ukraine, that's how important this dish is to us, you know, and that's already like is a proof that it's the biggest dish in Ukraine, and borscht is the biggest in Ukraine out of all of the countries. I can say that quite confidently, I think, because not only it varies like from west to north to south, whatever, like there's a, from village to village, you would get like different variations or whatever, you know, very specific local variations. So yeah, but food in general, obviously, like, we can't say like, oh, you know, colonialism hasn't claimed this or that. I mean, like in Soviet Union, it was just horrendous, wasn't it? Like the whole like process of standardization, you know, is horrific. It was just like, oh, this is a standard recipe for borscht. This is a standard recipe for plov. You know, ciao, see you later. Everything else, you know, like forget about it, people. This is what we're gonna be cooking in our canteens. You know, so thank God for our grandmothers and, you know, just home cooks that have preserved little idiosyncrasies like within families and within different regions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I fail as a Ukrainian because I'm terrible at cooking.
No.
But my husband is amazing at cooking. You know, some of the recipes that we cherish the most are the recipes that come handwritten from his grandma, and that would hand over through generations. And it's completely not what, you know, books at that time would present as Ukrainian recipes, because in totalitarian state under Russian colonial rule, only something that is sanctioned by the state could be published, as even in such things as books of recipes, right? Something that was sanctioned by the state and should be therefore qualified as an official recipe. But a lot of those recipes survived through those handwritten notes passed down through the families. We have the same cookbooks, basically just handwritten tetradi in family, where yeah. people just passed down through generations. And only now I appreciate it so much.
Oh, I always encourage people to, you know, to either dig up those tetradi or to just speak to their surviving kind of grandparents. And whenever I traveled around Ukraine, if I meet someone, you know, well, anyone that I meet, but especially if it was a cook over kind of like 70 years old, I'd be like, okay, like my mission was to find all of those recipes that may have been not written about or may have been forgotten. You know, it was definitely like a thing. I was just like, okay, I'm going into this region. And one of the first questions that I would ask after obviously getting to know the person a little bit would be, you know, do you remember other dishes that maybe your mom or your grandmother even made that, you know, for some reason fell out of favor or you stopped cooking for whatever reason, you know? And yeah. I got some really good ones, and I was, you know, I was really happy about that. But you are absolutely right. Like, it's been, individuality has been suppressed in culinary terms as well, so horrifically. You know, you look at cookbooks from the early 20th century, Ukrainian cookbooks, well, it's, you know, the ones that survive are from kind of like Galicia, obviously, like Western Ukraine. And there are ingredients like artichokes and I don't know, asparagus and stuff, you know, like there's so much variety there that, and that has been completely lost. And I have a friend called Elizabeth Lord, who is a British writer, food writer, and a memoirist. And she was, she actually traveled around Ukraine in 1989 or something like that. She went to meet Rusini in Western Ukraine, and she went to Romania as well. And then, and one of her stories is that she met someone in Romania, where the woman remembers how they've been told by the, you know, Soviet authorities or whatever, for the whole village to bring their notebooks, to bring their home cookbooks, basically the handwritten stuff, and to burn them all in a bonfire, basically. And of course, like, the women were like, okay, let's bring some bullshit book thing out and like burn it. But really, they've saved the stuff. But it was, how horrific is that? I can't, yeah. You know, oh my God.
What have been some of the most frustrating things that you've seen about Ukraine from Western media, Western pundits and things like that? What are some things you'd like to like call out, or not call out, but like maybe ask people to reconsider, or things that have just been frustrating you from around you, basically?
I think, you know, like, well, obviously just recently the whole call for appeasement or whatever is a really sore, you know, it's a sore kind of a very extremely painful thing for me to see, to this kind of like to give up territory, like, oh, give up territory, you know, and everything is going to be okay. And it's scary, and it's, what, you know, territory, like, it reminds me of, you know, the scramble for Africa, you know, when white men just sat at the table, got a ruler out, got a pencil out, you know, like crossed some things over, and, you know, like rearranged the whole freaking continent with horrific you know, results, and so many wars and etc. And how can people treat a country which is not just a thing on a map, you know, it's people, it's, so what, shall we give away, like, Kherson, my region? Like, Kherson region is huge. It's massive. Are you kidding me? But even if it was small, you know, people, it's people. It's people living there. It's people's livelihoods. It's people's homes and their land and their gardens and their animals and their friends and their old, you know, their grandmothers that can't leave, even if, you know, It's horrific. My friend, who was forced to leave Kakhovka the day after my parents did, you know, because she was so scared. She's in Lviv now. Her dad died last week, and she couldn't be with him, you know, because her parents remained. And it's like, how can anybody say for us to just give up and to say that? I don't know if that's the question you were asking. Sorry,
yeah,
but it's
no.
a really sore subject at the moment.
Yeah. It's something we feel, everyone. Like the other day, yesterday, because it was extra emotional, and I was thinking about our village house in the village on the occupied territories, and I just suddenly, we talked with my mom about our old photographs of her parents, my grandparents, and I just imagined those houses being robbed by occupiers and how they would definitely, you know, desecrate, and it's just it became this, the whole thought of, you know, this, there are photographs of course, but the whole thought that somebody would do something with our family albums that we weren't able to get it into safety would just devastated me, and I just like I sat and cried over this.
My mom and dad, when they left, you know, they packed the essentials. Like, they didn't really have that much luggage with them. I was like, what? Like, this is... But one of the suitcases was literally family photographs and mom's embroideries. And yeah. she was describing to me how she was leaving on the last day, and she was taking all the photographs off the wall. You know, it's... How can people even think of just... treating us and treating us as territories, or, you know, as a geopolitical kind of move or whatever. Like, are you people all right? You know, my mom, you know, on the last day of being there, she was just like scrubbing the house clean because she's so proud of her house. She's like, it's just like, you know, it needs to be spick and span, even though I might never come back to it. It's just,
yeah,
we
I think
come back. We will come back. We will come back to Kakhovka and to Melitopol and to Donetsk and to Luhansk. And this time around, not a single, I don't believe, like 99% of Ukrainians all are very resilient and committed to the idea that we will come back to everything that was stolen. I just maybe try, and because this is also a very Ukrainian thing to do, kind of laugh about what we cry about.
Yeah.
But I remember today's super cute meme on Twitter about handing over, giving up some Ukrainian land. And this is basically like a picture of the, you know, some on the West asking Ukraine to give up some of the land to Putin. And instead, Ukrainians bring a bit of soil and land on the Putin's grave. Like, here you go.
You can have,
this
you
is
can
the
have
only
some...
land
we that can, you're gonna get.
We can spare for Russia.
Absolutely. Yeah. But Maxim, you know, when I was little and I was growing up, I talk about this a lot, but we had this table underneath the walnut tree where the whole big family would like get together in the summer. And I've always thought, because I've heard all of these stories, like the horror that my grandparents had to go through and my mom's older siblings and stuff that were born during the war. And I always thought, like, how can they be so kind and so calm and serene and like really good people? Like, how is it that after having been wronged so much and being treated like this, how could they not lose their humanity, you know? And then I just thought, well, it's the answer is right here. Maybe in a way, you know, part of it is that, you know, the family was there and we were all sitting together and it was like basically family therapy in a way. You know, you'd have all of the food, you'd have like some shots of micronutrients, as my auntie used to call it, you know, like the homemade, you know, berry liqueurs, whatever. And they would cry, and they would like literally some stories, like everybody would just start wailing. Like everybody was just, it was intense. You know, when we were kids, we were like, whoa, what's happening? You know, they would wail and then, you know, within kind of like 10 minutes, they'd be laughing their heads off. So crying from laughing. And I don't know, I just feel like that kind of, and it's not just us. I'm sure that there are families like that all over Ukraine that have been doing that. And I don't know, I feel like it's helped us keep our humanity.
I'm coming back to the idea of family table and summer kitchens because it's so close to me. But also, maybe I wanted to ask you about the importance of food for Ukrainians. And I think this is where I learned, kind of maybe even instinctively as a kid, how important food for Ukrainians and bonding over food. And partially because our families went, especially in the South and the East, through man-made famine, the genocide of Holodomor. And I remember the first thing that I learned kind of connected with it through the family is that, first of all, you're taught that not a single piece of food is never wasted. Like there is nothing worse for you to waste the food. Like,
oh, gosh, especially bread. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Bread, but anything else to the date, like no matter how. You know, no matter how shitty food it is, I will finish it to the last bit because I physically feel uncomfortable by wasting it. But can you talk maybe more about those connections between our survival through generations and how food is basically linked this up and connects us to the story of our survival as people in such a powerful way?
Yeah. Yeah, so my, you know, sometimes I say the only reason I'm alive is basically because they deported my mom's mom when she was 7 to Siberia in a cattle train because she was, you know, they were farmers and they left, of course, they left the father behind to perish. But literally because they were sent to Siberia and they survived there, luckily, they missed Holodomor. So my grandma didn't experience it. She experienced other hardships in Siberia, but she escaped this very, you know, intense thing. And my great-grandfather, he went through it. He was literally dying on the, you know, on the side of the road. And then his doctor, his Jewish doctor, it's always been like pointed out, I don't know why, but they were like, oh, yeah, they loved him so much, found him, you know, and took him into the hospital and he hid him among the typhoid, the people that were ill with typhoid, because the Soviet authorities wouldn't go there, obviously. And he survived. So he survived. And then my grandma came back. But that kind of the sense of hunger it's definitely been a huge thing. And, you know, like people talk about Holodomor and it was the worst, but people don't talk about post-war years were also extremely hard, and my grandma grew up and she got married and they had their first, the oldest of the 6 children. And my mom tells me these stories how she would make these korzhiki, which, you know, are just like little flat, very simple flatbreads, and she would give it to my granddad so he took it to work to eat something. And one day he came back home and he just fainted, and she basically interrogated him, and she was like, why are you fainting? And it's because he's been giving it away to people, you know? Food cooked to you by your family, then sharing it with people, you know, starting from something like survival, helping people to survive. And then once, you know, people recovered a little bit and were able to kind of like, you know, buy meat and whatever, like everybody was just extremely, you know, I don't know if you, how it was for your family, but the tables are always heaving. Obviously there's never any waste, but there's also kind of this like overfeeding kind of like vibe going on, like always. And, you know, it's always been, but there's always this generosity, you know, it's this kind of like desire to feed your family, to you feed your friends, just to kind of like almost as a warding off of, you know, of death, of like anything horrible happening, but it's definitely like passed on through the generations.
Yeah.
And this like desire to overfeed, I can even feel it in myself, you know, I'm like, obviously I'm European and I've lived abroad and like, you know, I'm trying to be healthy and da-da-da-da, but sometimes I'm just like, have more. Like,
I can't. The Ukrainian comes out.
Yeah, it just comes out.
I still remember my grandfather who passed away sadly, but eating like macaroni with just white bread, and me and my mom were like, what's going on? Why are you eating so, like, just carbs on carbs on carbs,
yeah,
and, like, with nothing else? And he was just like, well, you know, if you survived through what we survived, you just, like, you know, carb load every day for the rest of your life. So
no, and but, it's
but Olio, I love very powerful thing connected to this that you do on, at least on social media, when you know, people write at you, and I'm pinning some of the tweets from your profile, people write at you saying like, oh, I made this this dish out of your recipe, or I combine, or I experimented, and you're always so generous. You encourage people to mix it up and maybe to add something of your own. Not saying that you in any way you're offended that the recipe was somehow altered. And I feel this is such a Ukrainian thing to do, because for us, cooking and is a very sacred thing to do in the first place because of what it means, how it's much deeper than just making a very tasty dish, because it's connected to our history and our survival, our bonding. And that's why for foreigners, when they attempt to do it through making Ukrainian dishes, it feels like almost ultimate tribute of appreciation that you can do, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I don't know, you know, obviously there are all sorts of families around and whatever, but in my experience, you know, we've never had this, you know, like, oh no, it's a secret recipe. Like, we can't, like, my grandma never ever understood that. She would just be like, why would you not want to share something? You know, like, I don't need to be the best at making this. Like, she always kind of like reveled in teaching someone, you know, something special, even if it's like a super amazing family recipe, you know? So I think, and that's what I kind of grew up with. So I think when I, you know, when I started reading, writing my books and stuff, it was definitely like a lot of that, my grandmother's feeling about that was behind that. And I love it when people, from all over the world cook Ukrainian food. I think it's really the connector. Like, it's in my upcoming cookbook called Home Food. It's, there are Ukrainian dishes, there are Uzbek dishes, 'cause my dad was born there, like this. All sorts of kind of like influences from my life, basically. But the running thread through it is that there's something extremely universal about food and about the stories that kind of like food and cooking brings with it. And you know, it's like the comfort of family and this kind of like human connectedness, I think.
Of course, and Ukrainian cuisine is, you know, is amazing, but of course there are, people have their own cuisines all over the world, but one thing that I start to appreciate these days more and more, that, you know, I have a Ukrainian husband and he cooks Ukrainian stuff. And I don't think I would literally survive through these months without, you know, having this connection to Ukrainian food and Ukrainian dishes and potatoes and borscht and whatnot. Is just something on the background. But I remember the first time he cooked borscht after some weeks into genocide. And for the first time ever, I literally felt like it's mending me from inside while eating, although it might sound really bizarre, but that's how I felt it while eating it.
Absolutely. No. I honestly, like, the power of borscht, I don't know what it was. Like, for ages when my parents were still in Ukraine in Kakhovka, at first they were like super stoic and like, don't cry, don't do it, don't panic. Like, that's what he wants us to do. We just need to be really calm and like, we'll get through this. And then after a few weeks, you know, I could see like gaps, like they wouldn't reply to my messages. And I knew that some days were so tough that they couldn't even speak to me because, I don't know, my mom would be crying all day or something, but she never let me see it. And then the one day came when we spoke on a video call and she was like, we made borscht today. Actually, we've made borscht for the past 3 days, you know, or like whatever, like every other day we've been making borscht all week. And she said something like, I just feel like it's giving me strength, like it's in our DNA and it's giving us this vital energy. And I knew that they were gonna like kind of, you know, that they were getting a little bit better, or they were like past a certain point of trauma or whatever, like they were entering a different stage. But that's when they made borscht for sure.
That's Saint Borscht and Saint Javelin. This is something exactly. That keeps us going.
Yeah.
Olu, thank you so much for joining us. It was, it was amazing.
Well, it's absolutely lovely. I really hope that we get to meet one day, maybe, you know, under some kind of tree somewhere. That would be really nice.
Summer kitchen.
Yeah.
Or this in Zaporizhia or Melitopol or just touring the country, the hell out of it, and visiting all the places that will be free again.
Yeah, let's do it. Thank you so much, guys, for having me, and thank you for everyone for listening.
Thank you so much.
We do encourage you to share our Patreon's page as well, because this is 100% volunteer, independent, listener-supported broadcast and podcast, and we need your support to keep going, and we're getting more and more of it. So thank you so much, but please share it, because we won't be able to do it, and we haven't been able to do it without your help.
This was a special Ukrainian spaces for me, because I've met now both of you in real life, and I hope, as you said, we'll meet in real life again in Ukraine together. So thank you for everyone.
But actually, what we're doing now, we're going to dinner, 100% all Ukrainians.
Yes.
And we're going to, I mean, you're going to be missed there, but I'm pretty sure we will compensate later.
Our first Ukrainian spaces family dinner party.
Amazing. Oh, have fun, guys. Thank you so much.
Okay, I think that's it. And apart from one thing is Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.
Слава Україні, героям слава. Муа!